Yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host with Live, and we are live streaming on Facebook because we are having technical difficulties on the Black Radio Hall of Fame, and on top of that, one of the guests is not in studio, so we are having a time today. But I want to, we're going to continue on because this is the session on our civil rights heroes, and we had two of them scheduled because there's some anniversaries that are here or coming up, and you know, we wanted to always connect the past with the future and the present, and so we're going to get to them in a minute. So again, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are live at Black Radio Hall of Fame. You know, any comments made by me are not necessarily those of the Harris Stowe State University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. So we're going to get started because we have in studio Percy Green, and you see him live on the video, hopefully. And if we get a hold of Christopher Hexter, who was part of Freedom Summer, hopefully we can get him in here. But I do want to say that we had some guests that were talking about Palestine a couple of weeks ago, and they put together some resources for us, some videos and some readings. And so I do believe the webmaster has put those up on the website, JamalaRogers.com. So we need to always educate ourselves about that particular situation. So we are going to just jump in now. What we have is Percy Green, and we named this show Action Heroes because that was the title that Sylvester Brown gave Percy Green in one of his segments of Take Five when that was still being published. So welcome to the show, Percy Green.
Thank you.
So I'm thinking we were going to dive right in with you because on July 14th, 1964. You and Dick Daley, in fact, climbed the arch. And, you know, unlike sometimes today's activists and protests, this was not a publicity stunt. This was for a reason. So walk us through the why part, and then we'll get to how you did it. But why was it important to climb the unfinished arch at that time?
Well, the reason, the rationale for doing it was to put a spotlight on the building of the arch, and at the same time, we wanted to focus that there were no Black employees, nor were there any Black contractors. The arch was being built by federal funds. At that time, I think they had the budget about $14 million was to build the arch. And we felt as if that some of those dollars should have come into the Black community, especially in terms of more and better paying jobs for Black males. They then was looked upon as the family chief breadwinner. And the fact that doing our research, we found that there were no Black contractors or or employees. And then, of course, the general contractor by the name of McDonnell, not the McDonnell aircraft, but the McDonnell construction company. They were the general contractors, and they told us at the time that they couldn't find any Black qualified to work on various positions. And we countered that by pointing out that how is it that the military, in this particular time, the military was drafting 18 to 35-year-old males for the military. And we argued that if the military can draft, and certainly Black males were part of this, the drafting, and teach Blacks how to within 8 weeks to fire weapons and to drive vehicles and do all of the military thing to kill other people. He can do all of this in 8 weeks and be proficient at doing it. How is it that the construction company could not train blacks into some of those good-paying jobs? And, of course, the official didn't have any response. He kept wanting to put the burden on us to find him some. So we said, that's your responsibility. And then we gave them 2 weeks in order to come up with some, knowing full well that the company was not going to do any more in 2 weeks than if we had given them 2 years. So he got bent out of shape about that. And so we left, and then within 2 weeks' time, we worked up the strategy as to how we were going to expose the Arch people, the general contractors there at the Arch.
So I'm maybe taking a step back because I'm curious as to how you all found out. I know sometimes when I'm driving down and passing construction sites, I always look at, you know, the racial composition. And I know sometimes you can't always tell the racial or gender identity of workers. But certainly, you know, back then you could tell. So how did you all find out that there was absolutely no black folks working on that project?
Well, first of all, we felt it was a characteristic in the city of St. Louis in terms of construction that there would not be any blacks on the jobs, and if there were, they would be doing the menial jobs. I was heading up the Employment Committee for CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, at the time, and we were just coming out of the of verifying the four blacks that were working at Jefferson Bank after that series of protests. And so the mere fact that we did eyeballing, driving by the site, and then, of course, we used some of our white members to ask some of the white employees how many blacks did they see on the job. It was that we were using those particular means in order to determine how many blacks, if any, as well that was employed as well as any contractors. And so consequently, after a series of these type of tactics or whatnot, we discovered in no uncertain terms that there weren't any blacks on the job.
So having found that out, now comes the planning, right, to drive the issue home that there's no blacks, and that neither was there a commitment to go out and hire them. So now what? What does action do?
Okay, now it's CORE at the time.
Oh, CORE. Okay.
Yeah. We had given the officials 10 days to not only hire 10% of whatever employees that they had there on the job, but we attacked the whole entire construction industry. We told them that we wanted 1,000 blacks in all job classification. Now, why did we do that? Because we knew that we were going to, again, produce 1,000 blacks, even in the menial jobs, to say the least, that they were going to do it within the time span that we gave them. And so consequently, we were already prepared to carry on some form of demonstrations against the National Park Service. The National Park Service was responsible for hiring the general contractor.
And Percy, I'm going to stop you right there because I don't know that most St. Louisans realize that the Arch grounds is federal property.
Yeah.
So, you know, people think it's in the city of St. Louis, so therefore it's under the city domain, but it is federal land, and everything on there is federal, which means that there's different kinds of laws and guidelines to protect that.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to interrupt you.
Right. The National Park Service, this is a federal department, and they were the one that let the contract to the general, to McDonald Construction Company that built the Arch. And so so after we had McDonald notice that 10 days we're expecting 10% of his workforce to be blacks. And we were homing in on black males, of course, at that time in construction. There was no black females weren't even thought of. And we're talking about 1964 now, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we informed of McDonald that 10 days, otherwise we would not be responsible for the kind of protest demonstrations that we might initiate. So they didn't necessarily take us serious. Within that 2 weeks period, we had to develop as to what type of strategy, what type of protest do we think that would capture the attention of the news media that would give it overall exposure to the community. So at my employment meeting, we were discussing various strategies, and it came up during the discussions that let's see how close we could get to the arch. Maybe there's a way that we could possibly climb the arch in protest. The arch at this point was 300 feet above ground. So Daly and I thought that we would go and check it out. So we felt as if that the ideal time in order to explore the conditions there would be at lunchtime, because usually at lunchtime, most construction people go to lunch, mm-hmm. and therefore they would be in a relaxed state. So sure enough, Bailey and I, we caught the bus. We went down to the site, and then we walked upon the grounds. And sure enough, at 12 o'clock, we heard the whistle blow. The workers then opened the lunch buckets and what have you, and sit on the ground away from the arch. Those that was on the arch, on the building portion of it, they came down on an elevator, and they too sat out on the ground. Daly and I, of course, we were dressed pretty much along the same line as construction workers. We had had Levi's on and the kind. Civil rights people then also wore pretty much the same type of clothing. So we then walked upon the grounds and then walked right past the workers, and we went up and we touched the arch and then walked right back through the workers and left the grounds, came back to our and reported to our committee meeting the following week that we think that we would be able to climb the arch. We noticed that there was a ladder going up the side of it, seemingly that it was the emergency escape ladder, because the workers went up on an elevator. So we reported that to the group, and then of course the next question was, who would be available to put forth the effort in climbing it? Daly was a student at the time, and I worked at McDonald at the time from 12 o'clock midnight to 7 in the morning. So it was the two of us volunteered. We volunteered to do the research of it, and then we also volunteered to actually execute it. And after that, we had to make the preparations as to how would we be able to climb it successfully and then at the same time have the news media to cover it. So we had to do some more brainstorming. At that particular point, we decided that we would do a diversionary. We would set up a picket line in front of the National Park Service, which is which is right there on Broadway across from the arch. And they had some binoculars there where the visitors could come and look over or look over toward the arch grounds and see the men actually working on the arch. So we said, well, we could take advantage of that. But first and foremost, we have to set up a diversionary. We set up the picket line at the National Park Service. And then, of course, we had to tell the press that we were going to have some people arrested at the National Park Service. And the moment that we would report to the press that we were going to have some people arrested, they were primarily thinking in terms of black folks arrested. And that really, that sparked their interest. And certainly they were going to come out to see some black folks being arrested and whatnot. So we put that in place. The next thing we had to do is to, being that I had to go to work at 12 o'clock, we had to make the arrangements of a bond for both of us, for Daly as well as myself, knowing full well that upon us, if we'd been successful, we were going to be arrested, and therefore we had to be bond, and I had to be bonded out in time enough to get to work before 12 o'clock midnight. So we put all of that in place. Bob Curtis was we selected Bob Curtis to be our spokesperson.
And he was also your attorney, too,
He was also our attorney as well. So that's the way we, that was the planning stage. All right, on D-Day, on the day of the event, July the 14th, Billy and I caught the bus again and go back to the arch on the arch grounds. Then we had to walk toward the arch. As we were walking, and this was at noon, it looked like that there were some people walking toward us, and we were were about to we were about to determine as to whether or not we were going to make another decision as to leave the ground, because we thought that maybe somebody might have leaked the fact that we were on our way to climb the arch. We said, no, let's go ahead and pursue it. Because finally, the images or the people that were walking toward us, they then joined the other workers that were sitting on the ground area. But prior to that, to make sure that, that those people would not be suspicious, I told Daly, why don't he walk a little bit? Daly, Richard Daly, being white now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I told Daly to kind of walk ahead of us, walk ahead of me, and I would walk slightly behind with my head down. In other words, giving the other whites, the white workers, had they been observing us, a scene of black and whites walking together, that would be typical. You know, it would be non-threatening.
I was going to say non-threatening.
Non-threatening to the, to the
workers. Here's a subservient black man ready to do whatever this white man
whatever wanted. Whatever we want him to do, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that was the way that we walked right through the workers and to the arch. And, of course, I was the first. I was ahead after we got to the point of the arch. I climbed up first, and Daly climbed up behind me. Now, the workers were at the 300-foot mark, climbed 125 feet. How did we know that? Because each step was about a foot. So they had some markings on the height of where it was. So that's how when we hit the 125-foot mark, we felt as if that was a safe enough distance between where we decided that we were going to remain versus where the actual men were working. Because we the thinking was, in the event there was an accident that would have occurred, a lot of time that happens on tall monuments or whatnot. We didn't want it for the construction people to claim as if that the accident occurred as a result of our activities. Mm-hmm. So we stopped at a safe enough distance that in the event of an accident, it would have been hard for them to try to claim as if that we were responsible. We told them that we were going to remain there until 1,000 Iraqi employees were hired in all capacities, knowing full well that we're only going to be there a certain amount of time because
you had to get out of here
to get to work. And get to work or whatnot.
Well, at what point did people notice there's some folks climbing the arch?
Okay, well, at that point, we had already notified a Kurdish. Looked through the binoculars there from the National Park Service over to the ground and then see whether or not I will be waving up and down. And therefore, that would indicate that we were successful.
Okay.
And so, sure enough, after we had climbed the point at the point that we were going to remain, I then kept waving my arms and everything up and down, hoping that Curtis would see me, and then begin to direct to the press that another part of our demonstration had been initiated and that two people were there on the arch. As a result, that's what happened. And then some of the demonstrators then tried to come on the grounds but then the policemen prevented
that time,
stopped them by that time.
I'm interested, there were obviously white companies that got the contracts to do the work. Was it one or more? Was it two? How many is it? Because, you know, I think about some of the bigger construction companies now who bid for these big jobs.
Yeah. Well, you had McDonald was the general contractor, and he had subcontractors, a lot of big, much bigger contractors.
Okay.
I can't think of some of the names now, but.
But my question was going to be, he, even if it had not been dictated to him or mandated that he hire black women, he could have done that on his own, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. He could have done it on his own. But a lot of time they claim as if, meaning the construction people or whoever it is that is responsible for hiring, feel as if that by hiring blacks that they create in trouble, the regular workers. Mm-hmm. And so they just assume to not be bothered with that.
Yeah, you know, right.
Because they feel as if there's some of the whites saying, well, look, you're taking jobs from us. I mean, why do you give it to these people? They're not qualified to do this work. And so that was the headset. But anyway, we eventually were arrested. We were there about 12 o'clock, came down about 5:30. And then the moment that we hit the ground, they placed me under arrest. They did not arrest Daley immediately. Daley, that's why, if you see the picture, Daley is still standing because the moment that we were placed under arrest, we would automatically go limp. And so, meaning that we were not going to walk to jail because the thinking is that we didn't create near of a crime to the magnitude of what they were guilty of in terms of discriminating against blacks.
But tell me this, Percy, though. Did they not arrest because he was merely a white man, or did they think that you had possibly held him hostage? Like, well, you know, I'm just trying to figure this out. What was their little racist mind going through? Like, they immediately snatch you down and throw you to the ground and arrest you.
I was arrested,
and
yeah.
There's Dick still
you're
looking
still
at
standing.
Y'all, looking at all the happenings, and they're not even looking at him like he's an outlaw.
No, it wasn't until after they put me in the cruiser, then they decided to say, well, come on, they would go grab him by the arm and say, as if he was going to walk. And then at that point, when they said, grabbed him by the arm, he then went limp. And then, of course, now they had to get another cruiser to come
and haul him off.
Haul him away. You know?
Yeah, I've often thought about that. Like, did they think you had held a hostage up there because you were there first?
Yeah.
But he might have been coming after you, a worker that, like, I see somebody up there. I need to get them off of here. Yeah, that would have been an interesting scene to capture that whole thing.
Right.
Now, they did capture you all on the ground, the aftermath, but no one captured with video or still photos you all going up.
Not going up, no.
Okay.
Now, there is some video of us coming down.
Right.
Yeah, but that is interpreted as if we were
going up. So you could have been either way. Yeah,
no.
So I want to just pivot a bit, because this is when I think Chris would have, some commentary, because there was a lot going on in the country as well as St. Louis in 1964. You know, people were fighting for voting rights, against for fair and full employment, for equal housing, adequate housing. So a lot was going on in this span. So June to August in 1964, there was an effort by SNCC, the Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Congress of Racial Equality. So they were pretty active back then, to decide that they were going to go to Mississippi, of all places, and do this nonviolent campaign called, it was really first called Mississippi Summer, I do believe, and then people just started calling it Freedom Summer. But they put out a call, say, you know, we need folks from all over coming down here, faith leaders, activists, whatever. We need to open up Mississippi to the 20th century. That's when a lot of stuff happened. I mean, they had young people coming down there to be part of the effort, and Chris Hexter was one of those young white students that went down. And so I guess one of my questions was going to be, what was the determining factor that he used to say, I'm going? Because, I often wonder, did people really know what they were getting into? I mean, we think about Mississippi, most black people that live there know the dangers. I mean, particularly back then. I mean, there's a reason that Nina Simone would say Mississippi goddamn, because that's just how treacherous it was. I mean, even between doing Freedom Summer, there were at least six murders, and we know that the most celebrated and recognized ones was James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner. But there were also 29 other shootings, 50 bombings, 60 beatings, and almost over 400 arrests. So these people weren't playing around. But the other part of it was the white lash for citizens there. So, for example, you know, they shut down some of the stores, so black folks didn't have anywhere to shop. Sometimes they lost employment. So it was this really sharp confrontation of who was going to win this particular battle in the war against racism and injustice. And, three folks died. You know, Chris Hexter was able to come back. He later went on to be a civil rights attorney. So those young people were impacted. What I wanted Chris to talk about, he had just come back a couple of weeks ago from the 60th anniversary of Freedom Summer. And so he reconnected with some of those folks.
Yeah. Oh,
so that would have been exciting to hear that. And maybe we can hear it at another time.
Well,
but yeah.
Well, also remember now, this it was in July the 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed.
Exactly.
Also.
Exactly.
And then I ended up losing my good paying job at McDonald's.
Yeah, a lot of stuff was happening in 64.
After climbing the arch, about a month after climbing the arch, I was terminated from McDonnell Douglas.
But, you know, when I look at all the efforts by folks of intergenerational, interracial struggle, because when I look at the three names of James Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner, it's interesting, because when you say the names, it's almost like you're getting ready to tell one of those silly jokes about, like, the Polish and white. But these were three people who literally gave their lives for folks to vote, for folks to have, you know, access to public accommodations and all that good stuff. And, I don't think we celebrate them enough, really, given what's going on. But then when you look at all the racial divisions in this country now, you wonder if a Jew, a white, and a black would stand together in solidarity against injustice, because it was just such a time that people were willing to do that. And I'm certainly grateful for their sacrifices and for, you know, people in CORE and ACTION, because it has not been for you all, a lot of what we do today and actually take for granted, we wouldn't have done. So I'm just going to go back to you had some idea of what was going on in Mississippi, and CORE was actually involved with that.
Yeah, CORE was doing some of the freedom rides, mm-hmm. to the area to get people ready and everything.
So I'm just wondering, how did those two incidents, you all climbing the arch and Freedom Summer, did they see those as connected to the same struggle?
No. They were just separate, and no coordination, no connection whatsoever. It was just incidents that occurred, just happened to occur at the same time. We were, action was paused just on jobs, because we felt as if employment, especially jobs that did not require degree, we felt as if that the NAACP and the Urban League were preoccupied with black folks that had degrees getting employment. And therefore, it wasn't enough emphasis placed on the masses of blacks having jobs. Had the regular intelligence of those that had degrees, except they didn't have the economics to have to go and get a degree. Exactly. So, but all of the overwhelming majority of the jobs at that time only required common sense and the ability to learn within a certain span of time. And we felt as if that black folks had the same common sense as any other people, and if given the opportunity over a fair amount of time, will be able to learn the same jobs that white folks had learned. And that was proven with blacks being drafted into the military.
Absolutely.
Blacks were just as good with the old M1 rifle and driving the tanks and mm-hmm. All of the other vehicles of warfare, whatnot, you know. So that just BS about all of the other. And when we brought it, of course, I mean, Chuck didn't like it, I mean, and then, of course, wanted to stall. Because on the white side of the argument, they felt as if that the consequences were greater among other whites than the consequences that we could have brought to bear.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But the mere fact that we were able to come up with the arch and then other flavors of civil disobedience and whatnot.
This was a time of not just extreme struggle, but of significant gains by African Americans. I mean, the Voting Rights Act happened. There were, you know, public accommodations, the whole thing. Yeah. You know, so there were significant gains that we're standing on the shoulders. But then when you get to of recognition, I know one of the things that when they were, you know, first of all, the arch has a museum, and the climbing of the arch initially was completely left out of the story. And this really, really inflamed people. I mean, I know that wasn't a big deal for you, because you weren't trying to do it for the recognition, but they were black and white people that just said, no, if you are going to tell the story, you tell all of the story. And in fact, it is, you know, empowering for people to know, even though it wasn't, I would say it wasn't honest and good part of St. Louis history, but the fact that you recognize that there was racism and that, you know, there were some problems, but, you know, here we are. So you get a chance to use that as a litmus test to say, yes, that happened, and here are the results, or here's the progress now. So there is a museum there that prominently features Percy Green. And in fact, I think some years ago, I can't remember if this was based on the completion of the arch, that they commissioned the poster for you. And it was a beautiful poster. And there was a limited series and pretty much ran out, and they did not want to, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was contractual reasons or whatever, but they didn't reproduce those.
It's so, a high probability that is going to be restored this year.
Okay. Okay. So we'll keep you very much keep you aware of that, because I doubt if it'll be the same one. Just not the way artists do. They like to do something different for each time. But it was a young person who was commissioned to do that last poster. And it went like hotcakes. I mean, you were signing down there at the museum, and people ran out, and they were a little upset. Well, save one for me.
It was a good poster.
It was a beautiful poster. Yeah, very, very good rendition of you with your signature black beret on. So we definitely will keep listeners abreast of that. I just want to end by saying that we have some struggles here. To be done, and I just, you know, when we think about construction, we see lots of construction going around St. Louis. Have we made progress? Are there actually black folks and women and folks of color on those jobs, or are we still fighting for the same damn thing we were fighting for in 1964?
Pretty much, I hate to say it, but pretty much the fight is still on. There is some progress, but it's so limited. It would be fair to say that we're still fighting. Let's face it. I mean, the population back then was what it was then, and the population is much larger now. So proportionally, we still haven't got a fair share of those particular jobs.
But why would that be the case? Because back in 1964. When segregation was the law of the land, and white people didn't even think about black folks except for doing the jobs that they just didn't want to do. So we've come this far, 60 years, and we still have to put into contracts or in what they call the request for proposals that you got to hire so many women, so many black folks.
Yeah, but see, those laws for most part are not. They're not forcible. Much of it is just only, you're trying to get get people to do the right thing out of osmosis, and it usually doesn't happen like that. But what I think is the reason why is because those of us in the protest movement haven't made it, racism a liability enough. In other words, if it become more costly to expose racism to the extent that that is going to eat into their profit margin, then they would be more encouraged to do the right thing. But most of the time, some of the civil rights efforts it's not exposed enough. And then once you expose something like that, you have to sustain it, because people got small, they got limited
short memories.
Memory,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So it's not enough to go and say, okay, make a charge and then don't visit it and don't continue to see and monitor the progress. I mean, racism is a business, and it's like any other business. They measure the profits and liability. Now, I'm saying that if you make racism a big enough liability, then folks that in businesses, they'd be digging up the dead to get some black folks to be part of their business.
Absolutely, because I'm thinking about when you all did something in 64 on the grounds, they had to think, we can't afford to have these folks coming disrupting every day, and we don't know when they're coming, but they're shutting down, what's going on. Okay, hold on here. I think we have, I don't know if I can get him in here. Can you hear me, Chris? Chris, can you hear me? Okay. He was trying to call in, and I thought getting with this setup, but this is kind of a convoluted setup. But sorry, Chris, I couldn't get you in, and we just about to the bewitching hour. But, you know, I could see how those folks would say, you know, these folks took 5 hours out of our work day, almost six. We can't have this. So get some black folks on this job. We don't care where you get them from.
Right. It becomes more profitable to get the people in there and get them working rather than to have your image impaired.
Impaired, but also you impairing the deadline for when you got to get this stuff done.
Yeah,
so,
right, all of that. Because you're cutting into production, because once an incident occurs, you know, the workers then, they want to know, hey, what's going on? The gossip thing goes on. I mean, people.
Nobody's really working.
And then some people say, man, I ain't going to work today. Those demonstrators down there, no telling what they, and then many of them are misled. They think peaceful demonstrators, they think it's associated with the firebombers, you know. And so some of them say, I'm calling in for a vacation. And so the whole entire production goes down. Wow. So then management has to make a decision. Hey, go ahead and hire Fred and get his cousins in here too, you know. I mean, we're going to end this stuff here.
Right.
That's what we have to do. Right. But you know, sometimes
it's organization. It's being organized to keep the pressure on. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you ever down to the Jefferson National Parks, what do they call it? Jefferson Memorial Museum, I think it's called. There is a special exhibit that is dedicated to Mr. Percy Green, our action hero. So stop by sometimes. I know that's. It's not exactly on the beaten path. You actually have to be going to the arch to visit. But if you get that close, go down underground. It's underground to the arch. And, I'm using my phone. Maybe if I was on the computer here, I could. Yes, you hear? I can't. Okay, you're actually on air, Chris, so don't say anything incriminating. You're on air. I don't know that we can hear you. Let me see if I can do this.
We can hear,
but I don't know if they can hear him. Okay, so now where are you and not in this studio, mister?
I'm not in the studio because I'm stupid and dumb and didn't think. And I got back from a trip yesterday, and I just, you know, but look, am I too late? I can rush down there.
No, we're actually on the air. That's what I'm telling you. Don't say anything incriminating because we're actually streaming now. You're on air. Unfortunately, we had to use my phone, so I couldn't get you the first time.
That's all right. Can I whisper?
We have you on, and Percy's in studio, so. But we got about 15 minutes before we go out. So I guess one of the questions that we were going to ask is give us a report back from the 60th anniversary of Freedom Summer. You just had that.
I'm live in the studio and you want me to talk about that.
Yes.
Well, Jamala, it was a wonderful event. I mean, first of all, I want to say hello to Percy. Hello, Percy.
Hey, hello, Chris.
How are you?
Oh, mainly without, but no one seemed to care.
Well, I care.
Okay.
So just more importantly than talking about what happened in Mississippi, I do want to tell the audience something that's very special to me about Percy. So I was just, I was 18 going on 19, and it was the summer of 1963, and a woman who was well-known in feminist history, Shulamith Firestone, was living in St. Louis at the time, and my sister Anne went over with me to Shuli's house, and she said she was going to a meeting at CORE, which was then on, as Percy knows, on Easton Avenue, one block east of Grand. So I say, well, I'd love to do that because I had an interest in civil rights. And so I I go down there, and the first person I met getting was Percy. And Percy spent, like, we had arrived early, so Percy spent an hour talking about the history of CORE and the history of civil rights in St. Louis, and the fact that St. Louis was never going to make it because it was about the same size then as the District of Columbia, and we were competing and going to lose.
So
we
lost the whole broadcast. I'm not quite sure. So this must be a good time for us to call it quits. And if Bob Hansman had his music together, we would have to be off air anyway. So I just wanted to make some announcements about the because we got some double dipping here, y'all. So you have to pick and choose where you want to go this weekend. So this weekend is the absolute last week of King Headley II at the St. Louis Black Repertory Theater. So get in there. It is a fantastic play, and you will enjoy it. Also at the same time is Club Riviera. They're going to have some jazz there, and some of the old-timers might remember that was Jordan Chambers' little club. So they're going to have some jazz there this week. And so go to that if you can. All of this is on the website in case you don't get all the details. Also this week is the National Black United Front is having their 45th convention in Kansas City. So if you're in striking distance of that, please check that out. Tomorrow, July 11th, remember when we had Ben Phillips on talking about the radiation that was sprayed on to the residents of. Remember, he said the film was coming back, the documentary. That is going to be tomorrow. So you don't want to miss that. If you hadn't seen that, you heard him talk about it, but nothing is like seeing the visuals of that.
Where?
That is going to be, I don't know. As that also is on the website, my website. So if I can pull that up before we leave, I'm going to do that. But the other thing that's going on is the abolition series by the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, and that is at the Deacon Center, 1000 North Kings Highway. And, that's free and open to the public if you want to know more about abolition and what that means and how it's we would like for it to look here. Come to that. That's at 6 o'clock. And what else is going on, Percy? Some we had feast then famine. Nothing's going on, and all of a sudden there's all kinds of stuff going on. But this episode and previous episodes will all be on the website, JamalaRogers.com. And Target St. Louis is going to be, a minute here, at the Missouri History Museum. So that's pretty centrally located, so, check that out. Volume 1, and that in it deals with the covert experimental testing done by your U.S. government on poor black folks in Pruitt-Igoe, so check that out. So we enjoyed, this was a kind of crazy broadcast because our technology didn't quite work the way we wanted it to, but we got Percy Green in here and parts of Chris Hexter, so you got some flavor of what it meant to be an activist and an organizer in 1964. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the battlefield. Right now.